of the crop.
Hello and welcome to the 140th edition of the Gooner Podcast. This is your host, Kevin Witcher. Once again, stepping in for Mark Ollington. And frankly, it does look like I might be doing this on a fairly regular basis now, as our number one host, due to take part this evening, had to pull out due to a work meeting. At least that's what he told us. So, we are recording on a Monday evening in the middle of the second international break of this autumn. Arsenal's last game was a 3-0 win against Manchester United. They next take the field to play Watford on Saturday tea time. And we are back in our traditional community centre venue as our more recent hosts, Pyebury Corner, are currently not open on Mondays and Tuesdays. Those who did not appreciate the background ambience of pies being ordered, door slamming and police sirens on the Holloway Road will doubtless be relieved. Anyway, time for the introductions of tonight's panel, which I will keep fairly brief, as there is much to discuss. First up, making it 2 months in a row, something we haven't experienced for an eternity, and drinking a New World red wine this evening, it's a warm welcome to regular Gooner columnist known to most as the Highbury Spy, but to us, it's hello to Mr. Steve Ashford.
Good evening, and having missed the last issue, I couldn't miss the podcast.
Good to have you here. Next up, a publisher extraordinaire and a man who speaks at least three languages. He's watched Arsenal matches so far this season in Spain, Germany, London pubs, and even on occasion in the stadium itself. With a bottle of San Pellegrino at hand, it's good evening to Mr. Mustafa Goldstein.
Hello.
And last but by no means least, last time he was on the panel, he was accompanied by an ESPN film crew from Brazil, footage of which I have yet to see. But we have no doubt the podcast gang will be mobbed should we ever set foot in Rio de Janeiro. It's great to see the return of sometime Gooner contributor and regular Arseblog columnist, amongst many other outlets for his talents, nursing a rather large bottle of Leffy, as we couldn't find any Efes for him. It's welcome back, Mr. Tim Stillman.
Bon night.
Right, gentlemen, we've got a lot of topics and questions submitted via Twitter. There's a couple here I'll start with. One from Mark Holmes, referring to our last match. Why can't we seem to play in the style we did against Man United in most games? And David Boyd asks, having been to a couple of humiliations at the hands of Manchester United, do the panel feel we missed a trick in not really rubbing their noses in it when we had the chance? Or is 3-0 satisfying enough? Tim, I'll start with you. Well, in a way, was that the real Arsenal we saw?
You'd like to think so. It's definitely Arsenal at the top of their game. I think the reason why don't we start like that all the time, I do think we start like that kind of quite often, actually, more often than we realise. Certainly in the big games, I think it's a real strategy. I think we saw it against Manchester United last season. I think we had three really good chances in the first half an hour. The last time we played Bayern at home, I thought we battered them for 20 minutes. And we saw it again against United on last Sunday. The difference is we put the chances away this time. That was the real difference. And I think quite often we see with Arsenal, actually the first 10 to 15 minutes is quite bright. And then if they don't score, the other team kind of settles into a pattern and settles into the game. And I think sometimes Arsenal maybe get a bit complacent because they've created a couple of chances, they've not taken them, and they just think, oh, well, we'll create another five or six and one will go in. And then we've all seen the story a million times before where the other team goes down the other end with their first attack, scores, and it's a much more difficult game. And so I think one of Arsenal's big problems over the last kind of 4 to 5 years, you know, even leaving aside some of the kamikaze defending, is actually taking chances. I think if Arsenal took more of their chances, I think we'd have seen an awful lot more from this team over the last 4 to 5 years. And that was what made the Man United game so brilliant. Was I've seen Arsenal start like that before, but kind of scoring all of the chances they were presented with was really, really refreshing. I think we kind of saw it against Liverpool back in April as well. And, you know, it's impossible to start every single game like that because, you know, that was really Arsenal at the top of their game, and it's just not, you're not going to get that in every game, and not every match is the same. In terms of should we rub their noses in it, I'd like to have seen it, but quite frankly, having seen us throw away quite a few seemingly unassailable leads, I was quite happy to see Arsenal hold it and let's take baby steps and maybe, you know, rack up a couple of these wins before we worry too much about that. I'm much happier with winning that game 3-0 than perhaps 3-2 or drawing it 3-all. So it would have been nice to rub their noses in it, but in the second half, personally, I got exactly what I wanted out of it.
Steve, I mean, Manchester United before the game were regarded as genuine title contenders. People were talking them up. Do you think that makes Arsenal the real deal?
Well, we won, well, not won, but we were unbeaten in three games now against Man United. Drew 1-1 at Old Trafford, beaten 2-1 at Old Trafford in the FA Cup, beaten 3-0 last week. In this calendar year, we've beaten City 2-0 up there. We've beaten Liverpool 4-0 at the Emirates. I think our record against the bigger clubs is improving. But I think it's quite telling that before the City game and before the United game, the players before both of those games apparently had meetings on their own without Wenger, and the performances were absolutely brilliant. So how much has Wenger had to do with those performances and how much has he not had? But that aside, it's absolutely brilliant to win these games and to, you know, to put United to the sword. And with regards to should we have rubbed their noses in it and should we have gone for more, having just conceded 3 against Olympiacos, 3 against Monaco and 3 against Anderlecht, all from positions of, well, not so much Olympiacos, but certainly Anderlecht, we were 3-0 up and let them back into it to 3-3. As Tim said, I was quite happy to sit back, let United have the ball, catch them on the break and not concede a goal. I thought that was brilliant.
Okay. Basti, where did you watch the game?
I watched Man United. I was actually offered a ticket with 45 minutes to go and I was in a publishing meeting with I could not, there was no physical way I could get to the game. It was really annoying, so I ended up at home with my iPad. So a friend of mine, don't tell anyone at Sky, a friend of mine's given me his code, so I can watch it on my iPad now, which is pretty handy. I know the diehard gooners will be going, oh, you should have dropped your publishers meeting and gone to the match, what's the matter with you? But I've got bills to pay. And I watched it on the, it was just brilliant though. God, it was just brilliant.
Were United bad or were we good?
I would say they were bad.
What's your name? The spy interjecting.
You can say they're bad as well if you want.
Yeah, right. Say they are, they're mediocre, right? Now I'll be honest with you, Chelsea, you know what, if they hadn't have cheated, I don't think they'd have beaten us either. I think Arsenal are better this season. I think Wenger's made mistakes in the European games, you know, not rating the opposition highly enough, not dropping players. He made 5 changes. From Olympiacos? There were 5 changes for the team that played Olympiacos and Man United. He's making too many changes, too much tinkering. You know, every European match is a big match. You've got to play Petrček in goal, you know. What I think where he's going wrong, I don't know if he's made a promise to Ospina or something, but I do think, you know, he should be playing Petrček and that first team, that obvious first team, that team that beat Man United, maybe with Koscielny, Gabriel, you know, a switch there. But otherwise, that is the first 11 for me. And he really, there's no need for him to tinker. He's got the Champions League and the Premiership are the first two most important things. Champions League because we've never won it, and Premiership because it's the Premiership, it's the champion, that's what we want. The FA Cup, yes, we love it, and it's great that we've won it 2 years in a row, and the League Cup, frankly, who gives a shit?
I think I want to win it.
Well, yeah, that's you, Steve, but you know, I don't mind winning anything. Winning's good, but you know, for me, the order of merit is, you know, Champions League. Some people will argue the league's more important than the Champions League, and then FA Cup, and then League Cup. So you play Ospina, and you play the people you want to blood, or the people who aren't, you know, your first team players in those competitions. You don't play them, you know, against Olympiacos when you have to have a win.
But in Wenger's defence, I must say, goodness knows it's rare for me to defend Wenger. The Champions League comes through every Tuesday and Wednesday, and then Saturday or Sunday. Tuesday and Wednesday, Saturday and Sunday. You can't play the same 11 players every 4 or 5 days. You have to rotate.
Wait, Olympiacos was on a Tuesday and Man United was on a Sunday.
But they were, those two teams were Olympiacos and Dynamo Zagreb. Arsenal should be able to beat both of those teams with a second string.
Okay, how about this? Players. Say you're Arsene Wenger. How about playing the team that beat Man United against Olympiacos, and when you're 3-0 up, take off the ones you want to rest and then make your change.
There is that point that we fell down because our second string is obviously not good enough. Not because we rested players, that the second string weren't good enough. You know, that's the problem.
Tim, are you a believer in rotation in this day and age?
Yes, very much so. Whether you make 5 or 6 changes at once, I don't know. I think there's a devil's advocate argument here that would we have started Manchester United with the sort of energy we saw had we played exactly the same team on Tuesday night. However, I don't think that argument applies to the goalkeeper, for example, and I think that's quite a strange one. And I think it looks fairly obvious to me that there's been a conversation with Ospina there, and he's promised him, if not the Champions League games, the games that he expects us to win. And obviously that one backfired on him. You do have to rotate, and I think we do have, particularly at this stage of the season, there are a lot of squad players who didn't really play much at the end of last season. There's been no international tournament, so the likes of Gibbs and Debussy have been kind of sitting on their hands for the last 6 months, and they probably do need games because we're going to need them as the season goes on. Whether you make that many at once, I'm not so sure. I'm a fan probably of a more kind of gentle rotation, 2 to 3 players at a time.
Yeah.
And I think he possibly, with the Olympiacos game, played with fire a little bit. I'm with Steve, that team should still be beating Olympiacos. The team that we put out in Zagreb should have been more than enough. But ultimately it wasn't, and when those decisions go wrong, then, and I think Arsene Wenger's said that himself, you know, I'm responsible for the results, and when those decisions go wrong, they go wrong. But I think in, you know, before the game, the only one that I was really worried about was the Ospina one, before the Olympiacos and before the Zagreb game. Other than that, I was fine.
But even then, you would never have expected Ospina to drop that over the line, given the form that he was in between January and May.
Yeah. And you wouldn't have expected him to have that much to do at all.
No.
Well, I remember, I went to the Olympiacos game, and I remember going in there, and just as I was going to, I was in the concourse, and all the screens were up, and they were in the tunnel, and I could see Ospina. I thought, what? Why on earth? Petr Cech must be sitting there thinking, this is what, he's sitting on the bench thinking, this is why I left Chelsea, so I wouldn't sit on the bench.
Yeah.
You know, and he's a Champions League winning, experienced international. I love Ospina, don't get me wrong. But, you know, Cech is clearly the number one choice for big games, important games.
I'll tell you what you do notice, having seen Cech in that Man United game, the sheer presence and charisma that he's got. I mean, he's got so much more presence.
It ripples through the side, doesn't it?
Than Ospina's got. Ospina's a good keeper, but he doesn't have much presence. Mm. And it's just brilliant that we've now got that presence in
and goals. Also the Manx, when they had a couple of chances, you know, it was, oh shit, I've got, you know, just that, having Cech there with his stupid little hat on and all that, you know, it's enough to put them off.
Absolutely.
You know, they're not going to, that shot they had right at the end of the first half, you know, I thought, oh shit, that's a goal.
So did I.
Yeah, so did everyone, right? But it wasn't, and that's Cech.
I thought Mertesacker was turned a bit easy for that.
It's been known
to be turned easily occasionally.
But it's not just the presence, that save at the end of the first half from Anthony Martial, that's just because Petr Cech's 6'5", and when he sticks his leg out, it's much more significant than David Ospina coming out and sticking his leg out, because there's more of him.
Yeah. I always had this, as readers will probably know from what I've said in the column, When he played for Chelsea, I always had a thing about that hat that he wears, because I think it gives him an advantage.
Yeah.
I think it gives him presence and an almost unbeatable air that keepers without the hat don't have. Now we've got it, long live the hat.
Yeah, long live the hat.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's change positions. I'll put this one to Mustafa, a.k.a. Basti.
Hello there.
This is from Danny Correa, and he asks, is Walcott finally fulfilling his position potential as a central striker? And has Alexis Sanchez an influence in the way he is playing now?
Yes, I'd say certainly Sanchez and Walcott seem to be linking up quite well. Walcott's also, I mean, he made, against Man United, he made a couple of goals, didn't he? And the tackle on Schweinsteiger, And the way he battled back for that, I thought, is that Theo Walcott? I thought, what's he doing? And then that other one, that when he put the ball out onto the wing, that really good pass from, he was in the centre and he passed it out to Sanchez, who went on and scored. You know, that's the sort of thing that he used to get wrong, or he used to sort of screw up. And he's getting things right now. He's maturing. I don't know, how old is he?
26.
So he's now, you know, this is it. This is his time now, isn't it? Really, it's now, next year, and the year after. He's got as a centre forward to prove himself, and he does seem to be putting them away. He's not Ian Wright. He's not Thierry Henry. You know, he's not got that ruthless streak. He's a bit nice. He does remind me a bit of a sort of Michael Owen type in a way. Oh, Michael Owen is probably a bit nastier, actually.
So not Diogo Costa, though.
No, he's not. Definitely not Diogo Costa, but. He does, you know, his goals tend to be accurate, or he doesn't sort of crack them in, does he? He's
not places like, them, doesn't he?
He places them, yeah, and so he's still got to learn a few things about, you know, when he could just chip the keeper instead of sort of, you know, screwing it right.
Like that one at Newcastle, the near post, yeah, which he missed.
Yeah, so you know, but promising, definitely promising, and I think the whole team looks really promising at the moment if he plays that first team.
His vision seems to be better this year. Walcott's vision seems to be a lot better than it was previously. And one thing with Walcott, I mean, he hasn't actually touched wood. He might get injured tonight on that plastic pitch in Lithuania. Touch wood, he doesn't. But he actually hasn't had an injury since January, since he's returned to the team. We're probably now seeing the Theo that gets a run of games, is fit, hasn't been injured for, you know, 4 or 5 months. And he's playing to his potential now. I mean, let's just hope that that continues and he doesn't get any more injuries.
Tim, I think we all saw there was some genuine aggression in Walcott's game against Man United. Where did it come from?
I think it's purely a question of motivation. Because how often did we watch Theo Walcott on the right wing when he was 17, 18 and he couldn't trap the ball and he couldn't pass it? You think, well, you know, that line out with time, and then he's 22 and he's 23 and he can't trap it and he can't pass it. You think, well, maybe that line out with time, and then he's 25 on the right wing and he can't trap the ball and he can't pass it, and you kind of give up on the idea that he's ever going to be able to. I just think the idea of being a centre forward is so appealing to him that, you know, he's not even played, I don't think, 20 games up front now. And we're seeing a lot of the flaws that I think a lot of us saw in the idea of Walcott as a striker, the physical element, has he got the aggression, can he do the press? He's doing all of that, and I think it's just purely because he's so motivated by the idea of being a centre-forward that he will fight for the ball there, where he won't fight for it on the right wing. So I think it's a little bit motivation. I think he's got an excellent partnership with Sanchez, because Sanchez has a lot more liberty to come in field and join him, because physically he's a bit better, he's a bit better in the air and he has a little bit more freedom, whereas Giroud and Alexis don't have any kind of on the pitch relationship. They don't spark off one another at all in a way that I think Walcott and Alexis do, and I think Steve's point is exactly right as well, in terms of he stayed fit for a little while, he's getting a little run of games up there, and personally I think we should just keep playing him there until such time that either he gets injured, which hopefully he won't, but or until it just becomes untenable. I really think that we know what Giroud can do, and actually I think Giroud's not a bad kind of plan B backup striker, but we know what he can do. He's been the first choice for 3 years. He's not going to really improve on that, so we know what we're going to get from him, whereas Walcott, I think there's a little bit of excitement germinating because we sense we're seeing the start of something and that actually it could become better and better.
His close control has improved a lot this year, I think. His ball being glued to feet aspect has improved a lot.
Yeah.
And that goal against Stoke, where Ozil put the ball, long ball through to him, he just took it down, killed it dead. And then as the keeper came out, he just had the nous to just put it in.
Well, that's just confidence, right place, isn't it? Yeah, whereas at the moment, Ramsey can't seem to do that.
That goal against Stoke was actually a worldie. The way he took that ball down, it was coming down from a very big height. He just killed it and buried it.
Mm.
The Walcott of 2 years ago, was, as Tim says, wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Well, most of the questions came from Twitter, but we've had one by email from Gerndog, and it's on this theme of Walcott and Alexis. He says, do you think Wenger will try Walcott and Alexis as strike partners, Ozil behind them, then Ramsey, Santi and Zikok in the middle of the park? At times during Manchester United, it seemed like we were using a 4-3-1-2 I kind of would like to see us actually give it a go. Thoughts? I mean, the impression I get is there's not much width there. Does anyone think we should change formation, or are we
happy? I think Sanchez and Walcott, they dovetail brilliantly together. And it was noticeable against Man United that Walcott was going all over the front line. Right, centre, left, dropping back. And when he was on the right, Sanchez was on the left and vice versa. They were dovetailing. United couldn't mark them, couldn't get near them because they were just dovetailing all over the front of the pitch. And with Ozil floating behind, also with freedom to roam, and Ramsey as well, I think it's a great formation, that is.
Well, is it a formation? Or are Arsenal now so fluid that when they had the ball, you couldn't really say that they are in particular positions?
Well, I don't think that's just an Arsenal thing. I think that's the way football's progressed. If you look at the way the big teams play, they'll have a formation for when they have the ball. And I actually think the word formation's a bit of a misnomer. I think they'll have their starting positions, but you know, the kind of positions the gentleman that sent the email there, Gerndog, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
I hope that's not your real name. you know, sometimes when we've got the ball, that happens anyway. And you look back to kind of the Invincibles in the double side of 2001-2002, you look at it as a 4-4-2, but really, were Pires and Lundberg ever on the wing? Not really. And was Ray Parlour a right winger in the 98 double side? Was Overmars a left winger? Not really. When we had the ball, they all had freedom to interchange. And you look at the way Barca play, the way Bayern play, I just think the way modern football's gone. Formation, I think, is a quite defensive word, and that's what teams that set up with discipline do. But attacking teams are much more fluid than that.
I think when you play like Arsenal did against Man United, which was those first 20 minutes, it was like watching Barcelona. It was like watching, dare I say, you know, the really good Man United team of old or whatever, right? Who, when you're that good and you're ripping a team to shreds, you're so full of confidence. You had the first goal, Ozil, like, you know, on the touchline. Basically, you had three up front. So you had Ozil, like, getting the ball across to Sanchez. Just anything goes because it's basically the Harlem Globetrotters. You know, when Arsenal's that good, we're like, it's showboating time and let's take the piss, you know, which is how we like it, of course. But you can't always have that. You know, there's a time where we will go back into our defensive shells, which, by the way, the second half, my God, there were times in the second half I thought, you know, we could quite easily fuck this up.
Giroud missed two sitters, didn't he?
Well, no, there was, two sitters were missed, but it's not so much what we were missing up front, but really silly mistakes, one or two again.
Gabriel,
you know, there were one or two, because Ola does it sometimes, just giving, not thinking. It's like that, I've got the ball, yeah, running around a little circle, yeah, looking at the floor, and then giving the ball away to the opposition.
Yeah, you know what it is, it's being caught in possession in your own half, when there's absolutely no need to be.
Yeah, lack of concentration, yeah, and general awareness. Yeah.
It was the same at Leicester. Whenever they looked dangerous, whenever they created a chance, it was usually because an Arsenal player was dawdling on the ball, didn't get rid of it quick enough, trying to be too clever. Just play the simple ball, especially in your own half.
And for anyone who wasn't in the stadium and had to watch it on Sky, Martin Tyler and Gary Neville as a couple of, like, you know, commentator pundits to take you through that game. All they went on about the whole time was, well, if Man United can get one back, it'll open it right open again. And I kid you not, 91 minutes. I think Neville said, well, I think even if Man United score now, it's probably a bit unlikely they're going to get anything back. It was so bloody lopsided.
I've got to put a word in for Gary Neville. I know he's a full-blown, dyed-in-the-wall Man United fan. But if there's any commentator, even including Thierry Henry, that's got a good word to say about Arsenal, it's Gary Neville. I think he's got I don't know whether it's respect from the old days with Vieira and Wenger and Roy Keane and the battles we had in the early 2000s, but he seems to have a lot of respect for Arsenal, yeah, and Arsene Wenger, despite what you said after the Olympiacos game. But I think he's got a lot of respect for Arsenal, and he actually quite likes us, I think.
Well, more now than he used to when he played against them. But yeah.
I think he basically probably respects the way Arsenal are trying to achieve success as opposed to buying it. I think he sees the merit in that. He does want Arsenal to succeed for that reason. Okay, we've got two similar sort of questions now. I'll read them both. One's from our regular contributor to the Gooners, Simon Rose, and the other is from Jonathan Houseman, who used to sell the Gooner for us way back in the day.
I've said this before, I'll say it again. Any relation to Peter?
Spelt differently, as I think I told you last time. Anyway, I'll read the both questions. They're pretty similar. Would going out of the Champions League genuinely improve our chance to win the Premier League, or is that a bit of a myth, asked Simon. And then Jonathan says, following the last two results, presumably Olympiacos and Manchester United, would going out of Europe on this one occasion give us the best chance of winning the league? So, same question, really. Tim, do you think it's desirable to go out of a Champions League? And presumably, in that case, we'd want to finish fourth rather than third.
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky one because, yeah, I kind of think so if we go out of it altogether. And I have a slight feeling that Wenger may feel the same, which may explain his team selection, certainly for Olympiacos. I was really drawn to a quote from him just before the group stage draw, and somebody asked him, you know, what are Arsenal's chances of winning it? And he said, we're not dreamers, which was really interesting. It really wasn't picked up upon that much.
And we could have a whole new podcast on that quote.
Exactly. He's probably quite right, but whether he should be so kind of candid with it is another thing. I think the league is really, really up for grabs this year. There's not a team that impresses me at the moment. They all look fallible. If Aguero's basically City are favourites on the strength of Aguero's hamstrings, other than that, which is a pretty kind of shaky ground to be on. Other than that, I think it's totally up for grabs, and there is a big part of me that thinks, yeah, if we go out and just go out fourth in the group, that we will have a better chance. But at the same time, I'm really not one of these people that would be dismissive of the Europa League if we were to end up in it. I just don't think, if you're in a competition, it's because you belong in it. I don't think Arsenal really have any right to be snooty about the Europa League because, frankly, we've not been a threat in the Champions League for some years. We're losing to teams that would struggle to get out of a Europa League group stage, quite frankly. So if that's our level, fair enough. And actually, you know, I'm not really one for prioritising competitions that much just because I think all competitions are contrived for our entertainment. Really, it's only the price on the head of each one that makes one more important than the other. So if we went into the Europa League, I'd really want us to give it a good go. And I think actually it might be a valuable platform for future Champions League campaigns, assuming we keep qualifying. But that's where it's really difficult because I do think there's a real sense that actually if we just went out altogether in the second half of the season, it might give us the edge.
Well, Wenger's never won a European trophy. If we drop into the Europa League this year and there's probably more of a chance of doing that than finishing bottom or qualifying, I would expect Wenger to go out there and try and win that competition 100%.
But what you're not taking into account is the Europa League's on a Thursday. And your argument of, you know, playing in Europe on a Tuesday and then Man United on a Sunday, you can wave goodbye to the league then.
But we play most Sundays anyway.
So wave goodbye to winning the league.
Yeah, but might Wenger just deliberately name a youth team for the Europa League?
Well, if he wants to win it.
Does it?
Well, no. But the point being,
like the League Cup.
The point being, he probably would be more interested in trying to win the Premier League than winning the Europa League.
Yeah.
So on that level, he has not. It's not unknown for him to throw cup competitions before.
No.
Let's face it.
But I would hope if we're in the Europa League, that he does his damnedest to try and win it.
Well, I think
I've never seen Arsenal win a European trophy in 30 years.
Well, I'm the host, but
you know, 20 years.
I would not be surprised if he threw the Champions League group to make sure he finished fourth.
Yeah.
Anyway, Basti, anything else you want to add? Or?
Yeah, no, it's just that. It's just that I feel that if we enter the Europa League, then we're going to end up where Tottenham end up because, you know, the Europa League it will bite into our resources and into our. It's a lot of games, you know, and. For what, really? I mean, I agree. Look,
well, for what is basically you don't have to finish top four and you will get
to the winners of the Europa League going to Champions League group.
If you win it, but that's if you win it. I remember going, watching Galatasaray knock us out in the final.
So,
you can get to a final and blow it, you know.
It's not easier to try and win the Europa League than it would be to win the Champions League.
It depends on No, to finish in the top four. No, is it easier to finish in the top four or with the Europa League? It depends who you are.
No, but come on, Steve, guys. What do you want to win? The Europa League or the Premier League? It's not even a question, is it? We want to be champions, right?
Yeah.
Of England, right? And that's it. So ultimately, that I think, you know, if it push comes to shove. And it's there for the taking. Chelsea aren't that good this year. The only reason they beat us was because they cheated. Yeah.
We had them.
We had them on the ropes, and Costa knew it. That's why he tried to get Koscielny sent off.
I'd say it was an even first half.
Well, even away from home.
Hardly on the ropes.
Well, hang on a minute. And then, Costa goes off and they're down to 10, and then it's not an even match, is it? So why he wasn't red carded, I'll never know. But they're not that good. City are fallible. Man United, we see what they're made of. This might bring you on to the next question. I don't know. What about Liverpool and Klopp?
Well, we'll get there. My question before that is, we have to play Bayern Munich at home first. Based on the Manchester United performance, does anyone think we could actually beat Bayern?
If we play that same team and we go out in that... The only problem is Bayern aren't Man United. Bayern are a lot better than the current Man United. And they have been for a while. Every dog has its day. I remember, when we had to beat them away from home. We beat them 2-0, didn't we? We needed
3-0. 3-0 would have taken us through.
3-0 would have taken us through. They are beatable. We can beat Bayern Munich. But they are bloody good, bloody strong, difficult to beat.
90 minutes against Bayern Munich, the way we did when we were 3-0 up against Man United. Keep them out at all costs. Catch them on the break. All it needs is one chance. Walcott takes it, Giroud takes it, Sanchez takes it, someone takes it. We win 1-0, 2-0 or whatever. Move on, thank you very much. I wouldn't go gung-ho because they will catch us, they'll pick us off, if we play into their hands by attacking and letting them counter-attack us.
But isn't it going to be difficult for Arsenal to start a game on the back foot?
Yeah.
Well, they need to use their heads, something they never use in Europe.
No, we're not that good defensively, though. I mean, the thing is, if we sit back... They could think, right, okay, we're sort of crammed into our own penalty area.
We've got four very, very good defenders.
That can go tits up too, because then they score and it's like game over.
If you look at Petacek, Hector Bellerin, Gabriel, and or Koscielny, Mertesacker, protected by Coquelin and Cazorla, if we play that back four, and they're all excellent players in their own right, all of them wouldn't look out of place in the Bayern Munich team. If we play that usual back four and just play like we don't want to concede a goal, and if we get one chance and take it, that's the way we
should play.
If you do
that, you've got to do what Ian Wright mentioned the other day. And he couldn't understand it. I've been saying it for years. Why don't we, in the old days, when the other team was attacking or they had a corner or whatever, you had Ian Wright or Henry or whatever on the halfway. Henry didn't do it that much. But Ian Wright was on the halfway line taking away two defenders. Now, Walcott is that player. To stand there on the halfway line and hit them on the long ball, on the break.
He did it v Leicester. Yeah. If you look at the Leicester game, I think now he's at centre forward, possibly there's more scope for it. At Leicester, he was doing that, he was going up to the halfway line.
Yeah.
I think with Bayern, actually, last time, if you remember the last time we played them, the first 20 minutes, we started like we did against United. We battered them. And if Ozil had put that penalty away, I think it would have been such a different time.
It would have been brilliant.
Yeah.
But we got caught on the break. Chesney conceded the penalty.
Ozil thought of all his mates watching on German telly.
I wouldn't go out there to entertain. I'd go out there to keep a clean sheet.
Okay.
Would you?
Well,
would you go out
then we want to play Petracek. Is he going to play Ospina?
That is the $64,000 question.
Plays Ospina against Bayern.
He won't play Ospina in a month or something.
I think he will play Czech myself.
Yeah.
All right, well, we have briefly alluded to the new Liverpool manager. So I've got two questions here, one from Adam Haylock and one from Mark Holmes. Firstly, Adams, they're similar, but I'll read them both. With Klopp taking over at Liverpool, do you anticipate them overtaking the Gunners over the next few years? And Mark Holmes asks, with Klopp now at Liverpool and Pep seemingly going to City, who will take over in 2017, or will Arsene sign another contract? So, I think I can answer that last one. Arsene will be staying longer, I'm pretty damn sure of that, so forget anything else. However, Klopp at Liverpool is interesting because here is a club that definitely would not seem out of place in the top four. And it's really whether or not this is the manager to actually achieve that, and whether or not he'll boot Arsenal out in the process. Tim, do you think the top four is a permanent state of affairs, as we sort of thought it was with Chelsea, Man United, Man City and Arsenal? Do you think it's going to fluctuate more now?
I'd have been tempted to say no at the beginning of the season, but looking at what's happening to Chelsea at the moment, I think this is the Klopp to Liverpool is absolutely fascinating on so many levels, and I really haven't got a strong opinion on what's going to happen. There's part of me that thinks, if I were a Liverpool fan, that's exactly who I'd want. And I think that the Liverpool board blinked on Brendan Rodgers pretty quickly because they knew Klopp was available and they had to move quickly. And I don't think that's an unfair move at all, because, I mean, I don't really rate Brendan Rodgers that highly. And I think potentially Klopp and Liverpool is a really, really good fit. And then there's another part of me that thinks, well, actually, you know, Klopp did brilliantly taking on Bayern in the Bundesliga, but kind of ran out of steam. His style of play kind of ran the players into the ground a little bit. They picked up lots of injuries because it's such a demanding style. And he even said in his press conference this time, you know, I don't want the players to think about the next game. I want them to think about this one, which is in many ways very refreshing. But I wonder if it has a shelf life to it. But I think it's so fascinating on so many levels, because on one hand, I think Klopp kind of has a free pass this season in terms of consolidate, try and get things together, try and get the style together, and then next year try and have a go at the top four, and it'll be fascinating to see if he can do it. On the other hand, with the kind of dire straits Chelsea are in at the moment, how quickly, if this goes on, how quickly do Chelsea blink on Mourinho? And if they
fuck
do...
Fuck off Mourinho!
Fuck off Mourinho! Fuck off Mourinho! Fuck off Mourinho!
I think that's a sentiment we can all get behind. But then who do they appoint? Because the only guy that's available is Carlo Ancelotti, who they've already sacked, and this is a problem for Chelsea. They've gone through everybody.
They'll probably get Ronald Koeman, and he'll do brilliant now.
And that's the other thing, because on one hand, this could be Liverpool's best chance to do it. I think they're only 2 or 3 points off fourth at the moment.
Yeah.
And Chelsea is still in dire straits, and it looks like a club with a really rank atmosphere running through it.
And well, actually, it has had. No change there then.
Well, but this time the players seem to actually be bothered by it rather than kind of empowered by it. And so actually this might be his best shot at the top four. And if he can get them in this year, then maybe the pull of him... with Champions League football, he'll be able to get the level of player and actually maybe make a good shot of keeping them in there. It's a really, really tough job, though, and I'm quite happy to see it. I think it's great for the Premier League, and I'm so excited to see what will happen, because I've got no idea, quite frankly, and that's how it should be.
Mm. Steve, I mean, let's just take a scenario here. Let's go back 2 weeks' time. Arsene Wenger gets run over by a bus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, has to give up work.
Yeah,
Arsenal go for Klopp.
Yeah,
good fit,
great fit. I really, really wanted Klopp for Arsenal. I think Klopp and Arsenal would be a magnificent fit, but huge but. He's now gone to Liverpool. Arsene Wenger, despite what I keep saying about him, is no mug. Every time Arsene Wenger, you think, you know, he's going to change, he's going to sign the players, he's going to make a go for the Champions League, going to make a go for the Premier League. Every time he lets us down. This summer, he had, let's say conservatively, 70 million to spend. He couldn't find a player better than Giroud to lead our line. He couldn't find a backup for Coquelin. Couldn't find a winger to put some competition and, you know, get us wide, get the crosses in and stuff. In short, he let us down this summer. Now Klopp's gone to Liverpool. We have to make the best of a bad job with Arsene Wenger. He is no mug. He's a good manager. What Wenger now needs to do is rise to the challenge. He's got to realise that Klopp is going to be seen as a messiah at Liverpool. He's not only just fighting with Man City, Chelsea, Man United, he's actually fighting with Liverpool as well now. He needs to rise to the challenge. He needs to get that checkbook out in January. He needs to prove to all of us that he can do it. He's not a busted flush. He needs to recreate the Arsene Wenger of 2004. He needs to see off Klopp. And I'm not saying he can't do it. He just needs to push the boat out, you know, get some players in, motivate the players, and prove to us that he is still good enough to be Arsenal manager.
Basti, in this country, Klopp is viewed as a bit of a loose cannon. Now, obviously, you are in Germany on a regular basis. What's the view over there?
Well, I think he's someone, his character is going to be important because he's someone who obviously did really well with Dortmund and got them into a, you know, very strong position for a while. But then it was, like you said, it was like he was running himself and the team into the ground, and he started getting, emotionally, he seemed jaded. He seemed like when Wenger goes like that, sometimes Wenger looks tired, you know, and you see him, but then he always seems to bounce back with a light little smile and a little chirpy kind of smile and sort of lightens, doesn't take it all too seriously. Klopp has this, it's a German thing as well, it's a trait, that when they get really into something, it's like, I must do it or else, you know, and he can get a bit like that. And I think he ran himself down, he had to take a year off basically. You know, and he ran Dortmund into near relegation zone at one point. So the thing is, he might have a honeymoon period, and he might have a, he might even win some trophies with Liverpool. Whether he can maintain a sort of consistent, level-headed, 20-year run like Wenger has, you know, for all his, you know, we bash Wenger, but you know, we are in Europe every year, and we are now again on a little insurgency. I mean, it's a bit early to tell, but every year now, we were third last year. We were nearly second. We could have at one point. If we hadn't had such a bad start, which we've not had this year, we've had a decent start, not perfect, but decent, and we're in second position. And look where Chelsea are.
Should be Watford Saturday.
Well, shoulds in football. That depends. But the only thing is, if Wenger plays the same team he did against Olympiacos and doesn't pay Watford respect, then that could come
fully
back and slap
Theo Walcott to score on Saturday.
Well,
expectations
lead to resentment, Steve.
Bayern Tuesday or Wednesday night?
Tuesday.
And Watford is Saturday evening.
Yeah.
I suspect we will see a bit of rotation, and it'll be interesting to see which game the strongest team's picked for. Mm-hmm.
Your view, Ken, your view on Wenger and Klopp.
Yes.
How do you think Wenger's going to react to that?
Well, I don't think it's going to make any difference. It makes life more interesting, but at the end of the day, we've already played them once. We've only got to play them once more this season. I think that's all Wenger will be concerned about.
But will he be more inclined to sign decent players, knowing that Klopp's going to do that in January?
No. Wenger is not going to be influenced by what's happening at other clubs. He'll be influenced by whatever agenda he's under from the board, and whether or not he fancies a player, and whether or not he thinks he's worth it.
Having Klopp as a manager won't half make for a great video. If it all goes wrong for him, you know, you'll have Hitler in the bunker and Gus Walter gun again.
Of course, yes. We've had enough of those.
haven't we?
Now, I'm intrigued by what's happened at Chelsea. I mean, they won the league last season. They looked pretty good doing so. It's all
until January.
Well, no, even after January, what I saw last season was a team that was programmed to get ahead and stay ahead.
Yeah.
So Mourinho actually knew they were going to run out of steam, and then after that they played their result football. And they were capable of both.
He didn't rotate, did he, last year?
He did not rotate.
Didn't rotate in the Champions League or the Premier League.
The irony being, this season, he's had to rotate because of the results. But, yeah. I mean, do we have a theory on why it's gone so badly wrong? Anybody?
I think he's such an arsehole that
he gets found out after 3 years.
I just think that the players, I'm sure that, like, I just think his methods are fairly short term, in that he goes for the kind of us against the world shtick, and I think that works for a certain amount of time. But he's such an arse, and they play fairly boring, stifling football, and I just think that players get bored of that after a while. I've got no real strong opinion on this, but I'd be fascinated to know from inside the club how much the Eva Canero situation has taken a toll, if at all. Because to be fair, I think, did they lose to Man City before? No, they lost to Man City straight after that, didn't they?
Mm.
But I mean, even before that, they didn't start particularly well.
Drew with Swansea. That was the game.
Yeah.
They were hanging on for dear life.
That's it, yeah. But I'd be interested to know if that accounted for perhaps him losing the respect of his players a little bit. But
Fabregas looks a different player this year. Totally different player. Matic, different player.
Yeah.
Hazard, totally different player. Costa, hasn't scored a goal hardly this year.
But also,
I think he's probably a bit of a bully, isn't he? No one likes a bully in the classroom. You know what I mean? And maybe he just went with that incident with the physio. It went over the line, and that might well be a play.
Also, Chelsea did a post-season tour of Australia. They did a pre-season tour of America, and when you haven't rotated your team for a year. And I don't know if maybe it's just a mixture of all of these things put together, but they did a lot of travelling over the summer when they should have been resting. And when you've got fairly, because they're not youngsters either, it's well documented that Mourinho doesn't trust younger players. So these guys are all in their late 20s, early 30s, and they've all been put through this kind of cycle. And I just think all of those things together have just created some bad vibes, and long may it continue.
And also losing John Terry. I mean, John Terry was their Tony Adams. When we lost Tony Adams, we had to sign Sol Campbell to replace him. I'm not sure whether Kurt Zouma or Cahill looked lost without John Terry. And even when they played together, they both looked lost. As we're all saying, long may it continue. I want Chelsea to lose every single game.
I'm going to put a one word a question which needs a one word answer, yes or no, to all of you. Do you think Chelsea will finish in the top four at the end of this season, Steve?
Do you know what, I think they'll finish above Man United.
Right, so is that a yes or a no?
That's a yes.
Right, Basti?
Reluctantly yes.
Tim?
Reluctantly yes.
Okay, all right. Well, we talked briefly about Tony Adams here. We've got a few questions from Adam Haylock for this podcast. I won't ask them all, but this one, I'm going to skew it a bit. He asks, in honour of Tony Adams' recent birthday, who has been the best captain since his tenure? Well, I'm going to say now, let's forget Patrick Vieira, because pretty obviously Vieira is the best captain since Adams. I don't think anyone would dispute that. Let's go with the rest. Who is the pick of the rest of the Arsenal captains?
Has there been a captain since Tony Adams?
Well, Vieira, but
since Vieira, right. Has there been a captain?
We had Gallas,
Fabregas,
Henry. Hang on, yeah. Gallas. Oh no, Henry.
Yeah,
Henry, Gallas.
Yeah,
Fabregas.
Yeah,
Vermaelen.
Vermaelen.
Vermaelen, Van Persie.
Yeah,
Van Persie might have been before
Van Persie.
Van Persie, Vermaelen, Arteta.
But Lee Dixon. When Adams wasn't well.
No, since Adams.
Well, you have to say that the captain, the deputy captain, Mertesacker, in the absence of Arteta, has probably been the best captain because he's led us to two trophies,
right?
The two FA Cups, and in that FA Cup run, we've beaten Spurs, Liverpool, and Everton to win those two trophies. On the way, I might miss someone out, but three big teams. Can't sniff at that. Mertesacker was captain. I think Mertesacker has been the best captain since Tony Adams.
And the way he comes to the fans afterwards, and he's an obvious Adams-like captain.
Yeah,
he's got that gangliness as well, that kind of slightly awkward
physique. And a love of the club.
So, yeah, I'll probably say Mertesacker as well.
I think the combination of Mertesacker and Arteta is actually, together, you've got the perfect captain within those two players. My answer would be Gilberto Silva.
Oh yeah,
actually, who effectively did the job for a season, and I think was quite unfairly had his destiny taken away from him, really, when Gallas was given the armband, albeit I kind of understood why, because it was a nice team of young lads, and he wanted a bit of a bastard as captain. Unfortunately, Gallas was a bit too much of a bastard, but
plus he was pants as well.
But I thought that season that Gilberto Silva took it, I thought he took the responsibility really seriously, started taking penalties, which he had no form for in his career. His goal scoring went up, and I think that was all just because he felt like it was his responsibility, and I think it was something he took very seriously.
Didn't Sol Campbell wear the captain's armband?
On occasion.
Question to the floor. Do you think we've had better teams than the two that won the FA Cups previous to the last 2 years?
Yes.
When we didn't win any trophies?
Yes.
2007-08.
We had better teams when we didn't win trophies.
Well, we challenged the league quite seriously in 2008 and 2010.
Yeah.
Would you say this was the best team we've had since we've been at the Emirates?
promising, no, most no, promising two. I'd say
squad, but not team.
Yeah, I think the 2008 team was actually very good. They were just unlucky like with injuries
and with Cech in goal. There is the makings of something here. I think we need a bit more spine, but I think there is the makings of something here. I disagree with Arteta being he may be a good captain on paper or whatever, but for starters, he's not really a first team player, is he? No. So how can he be the best captain?
I think in the dressing room and on the training ground, and I think he's clearly pegged for a coaching career. I think he's even in the last week coached the under 16s. I think I think that's one of the reasons they kept him on. Actually, yeah. They really see something.
No, I'm sure he'd be good on that level.
Well, I saw a tweet that ventured Arsene Wenger might be grooming Mikel Arteta to take over from him. Do you think that's a bit fun?
Not quite.
Goodness me, that's difficult.
Not quite.
Well, you don't know. You just don't know what a player... Tony Adams was a great captain, but he was a dreadful manager, wasn't he?
Yes, but he was never invited by Wenger to get involved in the coaching.
No.
Whereas Arteta has...
The thing about Arteta is he reads the game well, doesn't he? And I think any player that can read the game well can make a good manager.
And he plays in the collective and he's quite unselfish in the way he plays. And I think Wenger sees all of that. I think he's possibly setting him up for a coaching career, not to take over from him at Arsenal, but I think he definitely wants to give him his first steps into that kind of coaching.
He'll go back to Everton, won't he?
Now Klopp has gone to... This is just a theoretical, hypothetical question. Now Klopp's gone to Liverpool. If Wenger did get run over by a bus tomorrow, who would you get to replace him, Kevin?
Well, I would go for Ancelotti. Yeah.
Ancelotti?
Yes.
Yeah, Tim?
Yeah, same.
Basti?
No idea.
Absolutely. I would probably go for Ronald Koeman.
Yeah, well, I mean, if...
I prefer Koeman.
I think, you know, you look at someone to steady the ship, you know, if you have such a drastic change mid-season, and you give Ancelotti 18 months to basically create the stability to get someone for the long term later on.
I think the way Koeman set his team up at Stamford Bridge recently murdered Chelsea.
He's a good manager.
That Mane, do you think we should go in 50 million for him in January?
50 or 15?
50, 5-0. You wouldn't get him otherwise.
Not sure.
I think he is magnificent.
Okay. Right, anyway, let's briefly touch on the current issue with the Gooner. And discuss a couple of old players. We haven't got too long, but I'm going to ask for some memories from those who would remember. There's an article on Alan Hudson, Steve.
I remember Alan Hudson very well.
Please tell us.
Alan Hudson was a cultured, strolling, very charismatic, attacking midfield player with an eye for a through ball, very much in the mould of Mesut Ozil. Didn't like tracking back, didn't like running, which is why ultimately he never made it at Arsenal. Didn't run enough, didn't have chase back enough, but when he was on the ball he could just throw his shoulder and send anyone around him the wrong way, and he had an eye for a most fantastic ball through the middle. He could cut a defence with one pass. He was awesome. Strangely, the only manager that seemed to be able to bring the best out of him was Tony Waddington at Stoke. For some reason, Tony Waddington tapped into his psyche and got the best out of him. He was very injury prone at Arsenal, so he never really had a run of games.
Did he play in the 78 Cup final?
Not sure. Possibly. I think he did, actually. I seem to remember seeing him in the shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he did. I thought he was a magnificent player. Unfortunately, at Arsenal, he was injury prone. But if you put Alan Hudson forward 35, 40 years, put him into the current team, a fit Alan Hudson under Arsene Wenger's tutelage, he would be a most fantastic, you know, creative midfield player, and he could certainly
hold his smoke 20 embers a day.
Certainly hold his own with Mesut Ozil. He would be so charismatic.
Do you know what's funny? I'd forgotten about Alan Hudson, and earlier we talked about it, and I couldn't really recollect him. But when you said he had that really cutting through ball, suddenly it clicked with me, and I remember a couple of those balls that he did have that.
Yeah,
it's funny how you brought it back for me there, Steve.
He had a great way of holding his marker off, seemingly effortlessly, and then sending someone the wrong way, and then just putting a through ball through to someone. He was brilliant, but he wasn't a runner. He wouldn't take players on and get a cross in, that he just had it all naturally. He was brilliant.
Okay, there's also an article recalling Paul Davis. A little bit more of your era.
Yeah. Paul Davis was a fixture in Arsenal's midfield when I first started going, albeit kind of when I got my first season ticket in 1992, this was an era where Paul Davis had been completely frozen out and spent 18 months in the reserves because for some reason I think Graham blamed him for the Benfica defeat. I really, really liked Paul Davis, and he was kind of getting on in years when I saw him. But to be honest, I don't think Paul Davis getting on in years and Paul Davis as a young man were
because he never ran
either. Well, exactly. Yeah, he was one of those guys who, when he got the ball, time seemed to slow down in both a good and a kind of bad way. But also, you know, Paul Davis kind of came through in an era in the 80s where you couldn't get by in the English top flight by just being a cultured midfielder who could move the ball around quite nicely. He was, you know, he could look after himself as well. Fantastic ambassador for the club. And, you know, the way he took kind of, you know, Graham effectively taking that Benfica game out on him, and Davis missed a lot of the kind of the FA Cup and the League Cup winning season and the rest of it. And actually, I just remember how kind of well he took that in terms of he just kept quiet, he just played for the reserves and he just worked his way back in. And, you know, tremendously cultured midfielder, probably in an era where the cultured midfielder didn't really exist. And probably another one, like you said about Alan Hudson, if his time was 10 to 15 years later, would probably be an awful lot more appreciated than he was in his actual time.
Well, what Davis to me was, he was very much that part of the spine of Arsenal then, because we had a spine, you know, we had, you know, Seaman in goal, or before that Lukic, but anyway, and then you had, you know, Adams, and then you had Davis, and then he was the linchpin in the middle, wasn't he? I remember him sort of standing there. He was very, sort of stood there proudly, didn't he? And sort of like, he'd turn and he'd just put a pass in, and there was that, when he first started, it was that 3 degrees thing, wasn't it?
With Davis and Steve Williams were a good combination. Yeah. Davis and Steve Williams.
Oh yeah, Steve Williams. Yeah. They work very well.
Steve Williams is one of the best midfielders ever to play.
Cultured. It was a cultured play. He wouldn't make stupid mistakes. I remember him as being Davis would get the ball. You think, oh, we're all right now. He's got the ball. So he's going to do something simple but effective with it that's going to work. And that's what. Yeah.
Steve Williams was Aaron Ramsey with a shot.
Williams was my stepdad's favourite player, and actually, I suppose in kind of modern parlance, Williams and Davis would be called a double pivot.
No, Williams was quite.
It was a bit. Your
stepdad was right.
Petit,
he
was
brilliant.
It was like a poor man's Vieira and Petit, because of Vieira and Petit.
You saw Steve Williams, okay? Sure.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Right. What did you think of him?
I thought he was brilliant.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'll tell you what, my favourite Williams memory, I think I've probably said it on this podcast before, it was facing up to the chicken run at West Ham when they invaded the pitch.
Yeah.
And all the other players ran off the pitch, and Williams just stood there and fronted up this guy. What are you doing?
He wasn't at all phased. And apparently, from his base in Exeter, he's still an Arsenal fan now.
That's good to hear.
He had that sort of snooker player's haircut, didn't he? You could see him.
Yes.
There's something about Williams, he really should have been like 3 a.m. playing snooker with a little waistcoat.
He probably was playing snooker at 3 a.m.
We signed him over Christmas in 1985.
Yes.
And when the news came through that we finally signed him.
It was earlier than that, wasn't it?
No, made my Christmas, that did.
I think we signed a bit earlier than that. 84, maybe? December
84? I've got a recollection of 85. It might have been 84, but whatever Christmas it was, it made it for me.
Okay, well, on that nostalgic note, we are running out of time. So I have just got time to plug the current issue with Gooner. This one remains on sale for the home matches against Bayern and Everton. Amongst the contents are interviews with 3 of the Arsenal players arranged for us by the club, specifically Arteta, Koscielny and the Ox. Also a chat with the club's supporter liaison officer, a man who once guested on this very podcast back in the day by the name of Mark Brindle. As we may have mentioned earlier in the podcast, we've articles on Alan Hudson, Paul Davis. There are also contributors and memories of Arsenal under floodlights, as well as a piece on the club's worst shirts ever. And of course, plenty more in an advert 48 pages, including a Diego Costa voodoo doll on the back cover.
Can we just do the first worst shirts ever?
Oh, if it's brief, Basti.
Brief worst shirt ever, Steve.
Tonight they're all good. If they're Arsenal shirts, they're good.
Basti.
I'll go along with that apart from the green away kit.
Right, Tim, any particular?
I think this season's third shirt.
I think I'd like that. I saw it in the shop. I couldn't believe we'd actually have anything like that.
I can't even remember what it looks like.
What are they ever going to wear?
Hasn't it got lots of blue in it or something? It's like, what is it? It's
I haven't
horrible.
Seen anyone wearing it.
No, I've, no one will wear that.
I've seen someone wear it. It looks good. I like it.
Oh, right, anyway, back to the plot. And you can contact us via on Twitter at the Guna Podcast and on email GunaPodcast@gmail.com. And with that, it's just time for some quick goodbyes from Mustafa.
Just to say, if we play Bayern Munich in that third shirt, we're out of Europe.
Tim?
And deservedly so. Cheerio.
We will be wearing that third shirt in Munich.
Yeah, definitely. And it's bye-bye Munich. Yeah.
And after all that, we will be back with another edition in November. This is your host, Kevin Witcher. Farewell, and many thanks for listening.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee. All good friends and jolly good company. Well, hey!